BCFM 93.2 is a charity run entirely by volunteers. That means we are not for profit, so we can put you, the people of Bristol, first. BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
You can count on.
The security forces are already overstretched. If we can step up our campaign of civil disobedience here on Earth, they will have to concentrate their forces here, and that will give the outer worlds much more freedom of action.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The secret rulers of the NATO countries meet at the 2016 Bilderberg Conference. What have we learnt about their private plans for our future? Also, the killings in Orlando and Batley, and particularly Orlando, the geopolitics surrounding that. But our main thing tonight, last weekend, the secret rulers of the NATO countries got together with the apex of the German government to plan our future as their serfs. So who was there? We hear also the latest research from German writers on the origins of the Bilderberg, and hear from the horse's mouth how the Bilderberg try to intimidate German political scientists into leaving them alone. We even go back to the office of one of Germany's first two Bilderberg members in the 1950s, and hear who came to invite Rudolf Müller along in May 1954 to the very first Bilderberg meeting in Oosterbeek in Holland. Also, Dresden in Germany, where Bilderberg took place, is the home of the popular German Pegida nationalist anti-refugee movement, which holds a demonstration every Monday in the city. I got an exclusive interview with Pegida's leader, Lutz Bachmann. Plus, it's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. Our sister show, Dialects, back at noon every Tuesday, where we hear the full interview with Rich Newland, who believes the elite want to use a major international crisis to bounce us into world government if they can. Also, the man who shot JFK survived three attempts on his life. He's James Files. And Rachel Brody talks about the Guide to Reporting Poverty. That's at noon next Tuesday here on BCFM. But first, Martin, I think we should start really with the Orlando shooting. I wonder if you've managed to glean anything from that.
Well, I mean, obviously the first thing that comes to mind when we have these events is this a false flag attack? And for those who are newbies to this programme and to alternative ways of looking at the world, a false flag attack is something that is not what it seems, something that's been orchestrated from within the intelligence services, like the Bologna bombing in 1980, which the Italian police demonstrated pretty conclusively was carried out by the Italian intelligence services working with the other NATO intelligence services. And we've had a string of these, and obviously the first thing you notice is anomalies in the official story about what happened. Various eyewitnesses saying that there was more than one person shooting. Certain impossibilities involved in this. He wasn't using a fully automatic weapon, yet he managed to kill 49 people with just a couple of hundred shots, apparently. The fact is that he's got a track record. This chap has been working for G4S, and one of the things he did for G4S was working as an extra in crisis reproduction, you know, training exercises. His father, it turns out, has actually been on the CIA payroll in Afghanistan.
His father was doing propaganda broadcasts as well, wasn't he?
Indeed. And also, it seems that he changed his name by deed poll to Mateen, because his real name, his real surname is Sadiq, which is actually an extremely rare surname. And another Sadiq was involved not long ago in an entrapment case on people who were accused of being terrorists in Florida. And don't forget, Florida is the home of the Venice Flying Circus, where all of the 9/11 patsies were supposedly trained in flying airplanes.
Well, one of the other things which comes up regularly with Lee Rigby, etc., his killers, is that the FBI knew all about this guy. He was one of the people at the top of the watch list, apparently.
Indeed, and of course, they've said that he was... What the FBI have been doing for many years now is they go around looking for people with mental health issues, drug and alcohol problems, who have got some Muslim connection. They then approach them, pretending to be Al-Qaeda, whoever, ISIS, and say, hey, you, would you like to join us and we will fix you up? So the World Trade Center in 1993 was bombed by a group of terrorists, but they got their explosives from the FBI. The FBI even admitted that at the trial, because what they did is they actually set up the whole plot. They recruited everybody involved, and then the guy who was the recruiter was also the bomber, and he built the bomb, gave it to the others, and then he contacted his FBI handlers, but he also bugged his FBI handlers, and they said, what do you want me to do now? Presumably you're going to arrest all these guys. And they said, no, we want you to drop out. So he then dropped out, although he'd bugged the FBI who was speaking with him, and then the bombing went ahead, killed six people, with explosives supplied by the FBI. That's all on the record. And that was in 1993. And of course, what you're doing there is planting the seed in the people's minds that Islamists are out to get us. Look, they've just bombed the World Trade Center. Gosh, what a terrible thing. But of course, the whole thing was a setup by the FBI.
Well, look, getting back to Orlando, Donald Trump went straight onto CNN pretty much to speak to her, Jake, to CNN's Jake Tapper about this. And people are saying basically he's trying to cash in on this. I mean, he's one of the things he says again and again in this interview is he's building a wall, basically. He's building a wall right around America to stop people like this coming in.
Yeah, but the guy was born in America. So, he's a homegrown American patsy. He didn't come from it. His family came from Afghanistan, which is why his father, there's photographs on the internet, has been visiting the State Department in the United States. Obviously, one doesn't have time to look into all the details.
Well, I would just point people towards one particular article by Daniel Hopsicker.
Yeah.
It's called Orlando Shooting, Dad, a Longtime CIA Asset, Father of the Man Who Slaughtered 50 People in the Orlando Nightclub Shooting. Saturday Night is a longtime CIA asset whose TV show receives funding from the Voice of America. Basically where he starts, but he takes us on a kind of tour of all how these kinds of terror attacks have been being set up in by the FBI in the past, and saying effectively that the people who are doing them are very often very, very close to the intelligence services in the US and the FBI.
What they're doing is a standard procedure, because and we've seen lots and lots of this, is they're basically entrapping people. There was no plot until the FBI create a plot. They then recruit people to be in the plot. Then they arrest them and say, here they are, these terrible people. They've never found a to my knowledge, there's nobody who's been arrested inside the United States of America who is a genuine, independently minded terrorist. And it's very easy, when you're doing that all the time, that one in every 10 of those, you actually allow them to go ahead and carry out the attack. Although I would suspect that what happened at Orlando, just as in the Charlie Hebdo attack and the attack in Brussels, is the actual shooting is done by professionals, by people like Blackwater, XSAS people, etc.
Why is it that the media are not covering these reports, eyewitness reports, saying, I mean, one quoting one person, for example, saying, I mean, I'm pretty sure it was more than one person, witness Janiel Gonzalez told a bevy of reporters. Why do they just simply not report?
Well, what happens, as you well know, is that all of this stuff comes out in the first few minutes or hours after the attack.
I mean, he said guns were going off at the same time.
Yes, that's right. And of course, Trump's picked up on this and said, oh, well, there must be other Islamist terrorists out there, and Obama's such an idiot, he hasn't noticed this, and blah, 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 blah. What nobody's facing up to is the reality that most of these attacks are carried out by professionals, probably linked to the security forces, and then somebody ends up dead, like the Koachi brothers at Charlie Hebdo, like this guy, like the people who died in the other side of the United States. They end up dead. They're the guilty parties. They did it. They were radicalised on the internet, which is why we need to bug your phone, and that's all you need to know, folks. But in actual fact, the pattern is clearer and clearer. These things are set up by the intelligence services. And you might say, well, what do we do about that? It's the kind of thing that crossed the mind of many activists in the six counties in the 1960s. What do you do about it when you're facing up to a terrorist state? Question. I don't know what the answer is. There's the question. Ultimately, of course, we need an independent police force, which really is independent. But whether we've got that is a big question.
OK, let's come back this side of the Atlantic. Apparently, the murderer of the Labour MP, Joe Cox, was shouting, "Put Britain first." So in the way that was put out in the news to begin with, it sounded almost as if it was somebody from the Britain First group, which is a far-right neo-Nazi group.
Well, look...
But it doesn't seem to transpire to be the case.
No, well, if you look at the newspapers today, you'll find that the pro-Remain newspapers have put stress on him saying, "Put Britain first," as he shot her away. The anti-Brexit newspapers have said he's a lone nutter, there's no evidence of his having any political views of any kind. At the minute, my mind is simply open. We just don't know.
Well, some of the people that knew the alleged killer say that they would never harm a fly, that sort of thing. He was that kind of guy.
Well, it may be. I put this to you, Tony. If what we were saying before the hour, that the Brexit could lead to a collapse of the banking system, which it could, and you were in charge of running things, wouldn't it be very useful to have a very personable lady, woman Labour MP murdered just in the week before the vote to try and swing it for you? I only put it as a question because we have to ask these questions, and I'm going to vote for Remain. I was always going to vote for Remain. It won't change my vote. But you can see that these questions have to be asked. When is a lone gunman a lone gunman? Like Anders Behring Breivik, killing 79 people over 45 minutes on Utøya Island with the police nowhere to be seen.
Actually, it was Dwayne St. Louis said he last saw his brother Tommy Mayer around 3 weeks ago and wanted to send his condolences to Joe Cox's family. He described Mayer as having never been in trouble in his life. "He's not like that. He wouldn't hurt a fly," he said. "He's spoken to Mayer's mother and she is shocked and can't understand what's happened," adding he wasn't aware of Mayer having anything to do with guns or knives at all. And asked if the brother was a racist, he said no chance. So, I mean, it does seem like there may be more to hear about this. Well, it may even be, of course, and let's stress this, that Tommy Mayer had nothing to do with this.
It may be, but it's also quite possible that people who have mental health issues are suggestible. And don't forget that the intelligence services and other evil people of a similar ilk have been working on how do you get people to do stuff who are vulnerable. A lot of the people who end up doing these things are classic, vulnerable, loners, outsiders. And they've not been radicalised on the internet. They've been tasted up by the security forces, in my view. And then, of course, they either end up dead or on trial or whatever.
Well, they said there's been a lot of talk saying that it's 1992, early 1990s anyway, that was the last time a sitting MP was killed. But they sort of ignored the poor chap Stephen Milligan, who they say killed himself through some kind of sex act by putting an orange in his mouth. And he died in 1994.
He was hanging himself, wasn't he?
Yes. Well, I mean, but was he? I mean, this is a lot of questions about whether that whole thing was set up.
There are.
Because Stephen Milligan had been trying to do something about the paedophiles in the Tory party.
Yes, all of these questions have to be in our minds. There's no point jumping to conclusions. That's one of the problems with sort of internet gossip, if you like, is everybody jumps to conclusions. But the idea that these events are being used to manipulate us is a perfectly straightforward one, and I think there's overwhelming evidence in the past that this is what's been going on. So when a new event happens, we're bound to ask the question, is this an attempt to manipulate public opinion by the secret persuaders behind the scenes? We've got to ask the question. We don't know what the answer is.
BCFM. Now on to the Bilderberg Conference. And we start this week with one of the first people I met when I came to Dresden. He was actually lived in Munich, but he was happened to be in Dresden. And so I had a chat with him about the bombing of Dresden, which is where over 1,000 bombers killed 25,000 people. Actually, before we do that, Martin, maybe you'd like to talk about that, because this is, you know, finger is pointed very firmly at Winston Churchill and Bomber Harris as this being one of the great war crimes of the Second World War, the Russians actually being quite close to overrunning Dresden anyway when the city was smashed to pieces.
Well, in other words, the purpose of incinerating all those civilians in Dresden was a message to Stalin. And of course, we now know through Freedom of Information requests that Churchill recommended that the Americans nuke Russia before they got
this
a bomb themselves.
If you don't believe that,
he was overruled.
And if you don't believe that, you can check out an interview I did with the author Graham Farmelow of Churchill's Bomb, and he confirmed that Operation Unthinkable was indeed real, and that Churchill was urging that we send a nuclear bomb over to Moscow in the 1950s. Anyway, enough of that, and let's go back to have a chat to this elderly businessman that I met in over in Dresden by the name of Manfred Nussbaumer.
My name is Manfred Nussbaumer. I'm from Munich. I am just visiting Dresden because on a small business trip, and I have a little bit time to walk through the city. The first time I was in Dresden was in 1990, springtime. Dresden was at that time a very sad city. Still a lot of buildings were destroyed and not renovated. Now Dresden is really a very pretty city. Dresden, I think, was founded in 1200 after Christ, and then it developed to the capital of Saxonia, and Saxonia was actually a rather rich area. It has a lot of leaders and kings and counts, and it was in that area rather rich because in Saxonia there are Erzgebirge, and the Erzgebirge are small mountains, but they found a lot of silver, gold, copper, iron and things like that. And this was actually the property of that king here. And the king used this money to be important. So he collected a lot of art and he had a strong actions on military force. And also very great buildings.
A lot of the English historically were Anglo-Saxon.
But this Saxon, these Saxon come from the north of Germany. These Saxon are different.
Are they?
Yeah, yeah. And the Saxon in north of Germany, they have a connection to England. But I don't think that these Saxon have one.
Back in the Second World War, this was a scene of really terrible slaughter. 25,000 people over a few days were killed here, almost all civilians, and it was one of the most controversial acts of the Second World War.
You know, it is a very sad story. I mean, I can imagine that. I was 4.5 years old when my mother left the city because of bomb attacks. Every night we went down in the basement, and next day we saw damaged buildings and people killed, so we fled into the countryside. But Dresden had no chance. I think there were at least 1,000 planes, and they poured their bombs on the city. And this was really tricky. First, they bombed it with high explosives, so the roofs took off. And then they brought this phosphor bombs, and the phosphor started to burn the roofs of the buildings, and usually the old buildings, they had floors, beams, wooden beams, and they burned, and so the buildings had no chance. And the people down in the basement, they didn't get enough oxygen, and they died as well. So it was a tricky thing just to kill the people, and it is very sad.
Do you think it was justified? I mean, this is war, isn't it? Is there real justification for this?
I think it was not justified because the Russian army was only 50 kilometers away. So historians say that this was only from the Western armies to show the Russians how strong they are. And this was it was not justified at all. But it's now over. We are in a freedom Europe, and we are friendly to everybody in Europe, and I think it's the best thing to do. So
now, that's what this meeting here is all about. It's really, over the next few days, these people will be trying to save the European Union. Do you think they'll succeed?
Yes, the European Union will succeed even when the British leave the European Union, what I actually don't believe yet. But the European Union has to get a restructure. The moment in this structure, the Union has, in my opinion, not a good future.
But you have some experience with the European Union.
Yeah, the European Union is a very heavy-moving moving organization. You have to get from each country okay to get finally approval for decisions. Great Britain has one vote, Germany has one vote, France has one vote, and also Malta has one vote, and Cyprus has one vote. And this doesn't work. I mean, I always say, on a side, you know, not very honest, I say Germany should depart in 14 states and then move into the Europe, still stay in the European Union, then Germany would have 14 votes.
That's quite a nice idea in a way, Martin, there, isn't it? That, you know, Malta and Cyprus having the same voting power in the EU as an entire country like Britain, France or Germany.
Well, that's the whole point about not having a federal system. It isn't a federal system because historically it hasn't evolved as one. And, when, you know, the contradictions in all of this are becoming increasingly apparent. I shall vote for Remain next Thursday, but it's not because I like the current structure of the EU. As I mentioned earlier, Oscar Lafontaine has been suggesting that the euro will have to be disaggregated so that the euro will continue to exist, but it will, each country will have a will also have an independent currency linked to the euro, and therefore they will get more flexibility in their fiscal policy. Because I cannot see that we're going to have a fiscal policy across the European Union.
The obvious answer to this is to farm these decisions out, not to concentrate more power in the centre. But one of the, while staying on the Brexit topic, interesting to see on Zero Hedge that the Bilderberg chairman, and it's actually probably only Zero Hedge that point out that this guy's the Bilderberg chairman when he's saying this thing. He warns that Brexit is a possibility of Brexit is extremely high. That's Henri de Castries. He's the head of AXA, who's now slated to be taking over as chairman of HSBC later in the year, and he should know. I mean, the banks' intelligence networks are legendary.
What the banks are saying is what they fear is that Brexit will collapse the banks. Now, that's because the banks...
No, he's saying it's an extremely high possibility. I mean,
I'm just saying but Brexit is becoming more of a possibility. The opinion polls show that. But what will happen between now and next Thursday is quite possibly a run on the pound and a collapse in the stock markets, not just in Britain, but around Europe and around the world. And then those who are voting will have to recognise that that is what the stakes are. And even if you vote to stay, that doesn't mean the banks won't collapse. But if you vote to leave, you may be pressing the button on the whole of that. And okay, I don't think Nigel Farage understands that for a moment.
Let's have a little look through, we've mentioned Henri de Castries there, but let's have a look through some of the list of people who are at the Bilderberg, because this tells you quite a lot about the opinion. Obviously, well, I say obviously, but it might not be, but there's nobody who would be vaguely interested in Brexit invited to these meetings. They're all Remainers, they're all pro-EU. And one of the things that struck me was the lack of, in fact, we touched on this in the last week's broadcast, that all the ministers of finance were going in the back entrance. Nobody else was, just the finance ministers from Europe. So we're talking about Michael Noonan from Ireland. He's their Irish Republic's finance minister. Wolfgang Schäuble from Germany, the German Minister of Finance. Bill Morneau, who's the Canadian Minister of Finance, and also the Swedish Minister of Finance, Magdalena Andersson. Why would they all be going in the back entrance? I mean, the obvious thing is they don't want their photograph taken and be associated with Bilderberg.
Well, I think you've pretty much put your finger on it. It's all
but
very
why
well.
Why this year? Normally the finance ministers go in the front door. I mean, I spoke at a previous Bilderberg to the Greek finance minister. It was around about the time of the creation of the euro. And this is they were quite open about being there. Why this time they're so scared of being
because
seen?
Because everything is at stake here. Everything. The war with Russia, the migrant crisis in Syria, which we in the war that we started, because of course the British were, the finger has been pointed at the British for starting the civil war in Syria, and of course Brexit, because Brexit's going to lead possibly to what I was reading about this week is called Uscita Italia, in other words, Italy leaving. This is what's terrifying the elites, because if Britain votes to leave, they're all going to vote to leave, and that will crash the banking system, which is what Greece was threatening to do, but didn't follow through on.
Running
because, of course, what Greece leaving the euro would have crashed the banking system, but they didn't dare to do
it. Something is going to at some point. So
of course it is, yeah.
I mean, you've been saying for years, better sooner rather than later. The longer it goes on, the more painful it's going to be.
Well, indeed. But, I mean, I think those who are going to vote for Brexit next Thursday don't realise that they're voting to liquidate their own pensions, but that's probably
not necessarily. I mean, that's not necessarily true, is it?
No, I think it is true.
Maybe those pensions, whatever happens, are not going to
be available anyway. But
something is bound to trigger this at some point.
Indeed, and of course, I would have argued with Varoufakis that the Germans should have threatened. The Greeks should have threatened to leave the euro and crash the Deutsche Bank. And that's what Varoufakis was basically advising Tsipras to do. But Tsipras didn't want to. And also, of course, the Greek middle class weren't really ready to lose their savings
also,
for freedom and independence.
Also at the Bilderberg, you've got Philip Breedlove and David Petraeus. They both of them seem to... I'm not absolutely sure about both of them. Certainly, Petraeus was there early. It's almost as if nowadays the Bilderberg military people get together for a quick pre-meeting meeting.
Well, it's probably because they're the ones who are telling everybody else what to do. Don't forget, as Webster Tarpley pointed out, Bilderberg is not a decision-making meeting. It's where the junior officers, the finance ministers, etc., are assembled to be told what's going on.
About a third of them are politicians. I mean, senior people, prime ministers from all over Europe, vice president of the European Commission, president of political parties in Greece, for example. And these people, Ministry of Defence... people from Denmark. This is the most interesting contingent, isn't it? All these politicians in the same place at the same time being lectured by people like Kissinger.
Well, what's the important point about this is that if private individuals like Kissinger and corporations want to have a private meeting, who can stop them? But when elected politicians go to these meetings, we want a report back on what was discussed, and they won't give us one. As you know, Michael Meacher...
We also found out, by the way, that quite a lot of these people have got their personal assistants, civil servants, with them. Most of them, in fact.
Well, indeed.
We spotted several from different
George Osborne tried to take the line a couple of years ago that it was a private meeting, and therefore he didn't have to report back on what was said, but he took his Treasury civil servants with him, who were paid for by the British taxpayer. Why would that be? In other words, the whole question of Bilderberg is the illegitimate use of private power over public officials.
Now, Dresden is Germany is the home of the popular German Pegida nationalist and anti-refugee movement. Some call it neo-Nazi, but they certainly come across as very, very friendly and kind. They do have some bizarre attitudes, though, as I found out when I spoke to Pegida's leader, Lutz Bachmann, earlier this week.
My name is Lutz Bachmann, and I hope that Brexit is going to happen, because this would be the finish for the European Union in this condition as it's now. The kind of European Union.
What is wrong with the European Union?
The rules from Brussels. The rules about the bananas, how long they are, how loud a hairdryer is, or whatever. This is not necessary to rule the people in that way.
But they say that it's kept the peace in Europe for 60, 70 years.
But not the European Union. Because 60 years ago there was no European Union. Or am I wrong now?
So what sort of Europe would you like to see?
Of strong national countries by their own parliaments ruled and big decisions. Okay, you can do it together, you can work together, you can trade between the countries, but we don't have to be ruled from Brussels. Or like now with the CETA contract with Canada, the same. The European Commission is trying to force these contracts and doesn't care about the national parliaments. They just want to put it through. And it's wrong, because with TTIP it's going to happen as well. It's going to be the same. CETA is like kind of sort of a test project. CETA, people, no, they didn't go on the streets, they didn't complain about it. Okay, let's carry on, let's go for TTIP. That's the wrong way.
Okay, I mean, we've got an Israeli flag here. Some people will say this is a symbol of racism. Is the Israeli flag here?
What's wrong with it?
Yeah, because some people say this is a symbol of a racist state.
Is it?
Yeah, well, that's what some people say. You think not, no?
No.
No?
No.
Well, on the Palestinians?
No.
No?
No, the pigs in every country you have, under each flag, there can be a pig. They're normal people and they are stupid people.
Okay. What is the message of Pegida?
We've got our 10 fees, you know, about 10 points.
What is for you the two most important?
The most important, direct democracy. Direct democracy, people have to vote. Yeah, people vote. Vote of people. So that's the most important thing. Because if this is going to be one day happen, the other 9 points of our from our 10 will happen anyway. Because if you ask the people, they will decide the way we say it.
And what's your message for people in England?
Vote for Brexit. Vote for Brexit.
Yes.
That's the most important thing. Vote for Brexit, vote for UKIP and Nigel Farage.
Well, it's a horrible thing to say, for him to say there, Martin, which is there are pigs in every country, referring to the Palestinians. Probably the most interesting thing he had to say.
Well, no, I think he was saying that there are pigs in every country, that there are some Israelis who are not acceptable, but the Israeli flag is acceptable. But I think the fact that they're waving an Israeli flag suggests that they're not entirely just German nationalists, are they? They've got a wider agenda. And, of course, what Pegida stands for, I understand, is something like the campaign to prevent the Islamization of Europe, which is about as racist as it gets, really. And I understand that they have some power and some force, and it's interesting that you've interviewed them.
Yeah, very, very different to here. I mean, it's like most of the ordinary people seem to come out and join Pegida, whereas here they'd be on the counter-demonstration. Anyway, I also spoke to the Dresden police chief, who didn't seem to have a lot to say, but it was nice to at least put some questions to him.
My name is Thomas Geithner. I'm the spokesman of the Dresden police.
So my only question really is, we have people accused of war crimes coming here and also financial crimes, stealing literally billions of pounds from the public because of false accounting in the banks. So why don't you arrest these people rather than protect them?
I don't know what you mean.
Criminals inside, financial criminals, war criminals. Why don't you arrest them?
That's not my discussion. Sorry.
So you say they're not war criminals?
This is not my discussion. No. Thank you.
Well, interesting. Not my discussion, talking about arresting war criminals and financial criminals. I also got a chance to confront, gently, a chap called Jacob Wallenberg. Now, he's one of the people who features in the Paul Manning book, by the way, as the Wallenberg family playing both sides in World War II and being connected with the Bormann Network. So, how did I get on with Jacob Wallenberg?
Jacob, can I just ask you, if there's Brexit, what do you think's going to... I'm just asking a question. If there's Brexit, is it good or bad? Yes or no? You don't want to answer? Okay. He's very tight-lipped. All right, guys.
Jacob Wallenberg just didn't want to answer at all. Of course, this was all in a public space that I asked these questions, and they seem to think that their public spaces are private. Also spoke to a guy called James A. Johnson. He's the bag man, the funder behind Obama and Hillary Clinton for the Democrat Party in the States. And there's some good videos online by Rob Dew at InfoWars and Luke Radowski at We Are Change as well about this.
Hi, James. Can I just ask you? No, I'm not. It's okay. You don't have to run away. Please. I'll go. You stay. I'll go. You stay. I was just going to ask you if it's a up or down for Brexit.
Don't bother me.
I'm not going to bother you, but isn't that a simple question? Really?
You want me to get the security?
Brexit, good or bad?
Would you please leave, sir?
Get out of here. Okay.
Thank you.
What did he say to you, Tony?
Well, I asked him about Brexit. I just said, do you think Brexit is going to be good or bad for us? And he said, get out of here. So there's an answer for you.
You scumbag.
Jeez.
And he called security on me.
And who was that?
And, he says this is a private space.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this is the middle of a plaza, a square in the middle of Dresden. I don't think it's very private.
Yeah.
And if one of these people wants to crawl out from under their shell, I'm going to ask them a damn question.
Exactly.
So that's one of the funny things about this, Martin, is these people seem to like the fact that nobody recognises them in the street. They can wander around because there's so little press scrutiny of some of the most powerful people in the world. But also, one of the people I spoke to at Bilderberg is a guy called Rich Newland, and the full interview with him is on Dialect, noon on Tuesday. And Rich seems to think that there is definitely going to be some kind of crisis. He's not quite sure what, but here's his thoughts.
The way I see it is that they want to install a world government, and they want to get rid of the sovereignty of all the countries in the world. Now, if you were to go to the citizenship today and ask them, put in a world government, we'll get rid of all the different countries, the people would definitely not vote for that. So in order to achieve that goal, they know they need to create a crisis, a large crisis, something the equivalent of a world war or so, where the people at the end are all down on their knees and begging. And only at that point would the people be willing to accept something like a world government and to get rid of the sovereignty of all the countries. Now, how they're going to achieve that, it could be done in many different ways. And they have a handful of ways, certainly, that are planned. But it has to be something where the people are totally destroyed.
Well, give us an idea of what we should be looking out for.
Well, I personally think that, you know, we could be looking at a collapse of the world financial system, where everything just sort of goes up in flames. But I don't believe that that's going to be the case. We could also be looking at...
Why not?
Because they've used that sort of thing in the past. And I think that they're not going to repeat that. That's just my personal feeling. You know, obviously they're building it up. I mean, if you look at the debt throughout the world right now, there's so much debt we can never pay it back. So obviously it's going to collapse. But I think before that collapse comes, they're going to use some other type of crisis which really scares the people to the point of, you know, being scared to death. Meaning that, you know, we're looking at something like, you know, a biological weapon which would be used against the people of the world, where slowly, you know, thousands and thousands are dying off, and that is something that would really scare everyone. You know, and I think these things like the Ebola epidemics that they're part of, I see these as sort of test phases to see how will people react if something like that happens. Now, you could imagine if we had some type of an AIDS virus, which was airborne, going from person to person, that would scare the people so much, they'd be willing to accept anything if there was a solution for that problem. The other possibility that I see is that we're looking at what we would consider a third world war. Only, in my opinion, a third world war is not going to be countries against countries as in the past. I would expect more a worldwide civil war, where inside of all the different countries, you have civil wars which break out among the polarized societies that we have. If you look over the past years, the media is really being used to polarize societies along different lines. You know, it's along racial lines, you know, black, white, Hispanic. It's along economic lines, rich against poor. It's along religious lines, you know, Christian, Muslim, Jew. This polarization is being done in all countries. And that is a potential powder keg, which at any time they can light the match and that can go off. we're about to experience one of the most important conflicts that the world has ever seen. And it's really a question, will tyranny eliminate freedom, or will freedom reign over tyranny? That's the question. And we don't know how it's going to end.
Rich Newland there talking to me last weekend at the Bilderberg conference in Dresden. Martin, I mean, he's painting a pretty dark picture, but he's also saying it's one of the most exciting and interesting times ever to be alive.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure who this chap is or what his credentials to speak are. I think there's going to be an economic crash no matter what.
Well, should we, okay, let me just fill in for you there then, because it may be better to say a few things about him. I think he wants to keep some stuff private and personal, but he's certainly had direct experience of the military industrial complex in the US. His family has.
Okay, fair enough. But I mean, I think just speaking from an economic point of view, the guy who was behind the film the Big Short, who short, you know, bet against the stock market and won big in 2008, he's absolutely clear that there's going to be another crash. Independent economists, even mainstream economists, don't like to go there because I don't think they really understand the derivatives market. They still operate in a universe where there might be a recession, but the idea that the whole thing could just explode in their face,
I mean, what he's talking about effectively
really sunk in.
Is this shock doctrine, Naomi Klein's shock doctrine, isn't
yep.
it? The idea that people are only malleable when there's some sort of crisis. And I suppose what mm-hmm. Rich is kind of implying, that there may be multiple crises happening
well,
at
indeed
once.
There are. I mean, and the way that the structural elite have used the economic crisis since 2008 is absolutely astonishing. Philip Murovsky's written a very good book about this. I thought in 2008, and we were doing these programs in 2008, that this will be a turning point. Once you've bailed out the financial system with taxpayer money, then surely the free market philosophy is really dead. But it's like trying to kill Rasputin. They've actually, you know, we've poisoned him, we've shot him, and he's still coming back because it's a really deeply ingrained ideology. The fact that the taxpayers of the world have bailed out the banks ought to be the nail in the coffin, the stake through the heart for all of this stuff. But in actual fact, people are still going on about how we need, for example, to leave the European Union so that we can trade more freely
but
with
Martin,
the world.
Martin, these banks are growing bigger and bigger. Their debts are growing bigger and bigger, and they're sucking more and more into themselves. At some point, surely someone's got to say that bank is not viable anymore.
Well, that's what's already happening.
What? Smaller
banks are going down already inside the European Union.
I mean, if
Union.
You, for example,
the most
had
exposed
your own,
bank.
For example, if you had your own business, the banks would have foreclosed on you years ago, but they won't foreclose on themselves, will they?
No, but, and of course, the real threat is Deutsche Bank, which is actually a privately owned bank, but it's integrated into the German state, and its shares are collapsing, and they were going to collapse if the Greeks had had the bottle for it. They could have collapsed Deutsche Bank, which is what Varoufakis wanted to do.
Maybe the Brits will do it instead.
Well,
anyway.
Maybe the Brits are going to do it instead, but of course,
anyway,
Deutsche Bank is your pensions, folks.
I spoke also to German political scientist Klaus Kopf, who he's done a decade or so of research. He first came across the Bilderberg Group, I was rather impressed, in 1995, which was a year before I did, and he managed to get to the bottom of some of the early Bilderberg members from Germany.
My name is Klaus Kopf from Hamburg, and I'm here at my first Bilderberg meeting because I tried in 1995 to do my final exams on the Bilderberg topic.
Now, you were advised by one of your professors, I believe, not to do Bilderberg.
Well, it was actually not exactly my professor, it was a professor, and he was the director of the Hamburg Institute for Peace and Security Studies. He was the successor of Mr. Egon Bahr, former minister in the government of Willy Brandt, and as Egon Bahr attended a meeting of Bilderberg in 1971, I knew Egon Bahr would have some knowledge about this meeting. And so I asked Professor Dieter Lutz if he could ask, instead of me, because I was just too afraid to do this job, if he would have any knowledge on Bilderberg that he could share. And so, yes, Mr. Lutz agreed to ask him, and that's what he did. And he came back 3 days later after the weekend and told me then that Mr. Egon Bahr said, well, there are three good reasons for this young guy not to work on this Bilderberg topic on his final papers. First reason, if he is interested in a career as a political scientist, this career will be ended before it just began, because I would have worked on this Bilderberg topic. Second, as billions are somehow handled at Bilderberg, and as they would decide on peace and war, he will not find out anything about Bilderberg, so there's no good reason to work on something you will not find out anything about. And third reason not to work on Bilderberg is, if I would find out something, I would have to cope with personal problems. So I was, like, shocked. I knew there would be a kind of a conspiracy theory around Bilderberg. But to hear this from a professor was like a shock. And I screamed at him and said, well, you are the director at the Institute in Hamburg on peace and security research, which is not just some institute in the world. It's one of the top five institutes in the world. And you've never heard until Friday, when I asked you for Bilderberg, you've never heard about Bilderberg before. And now, on Monday, you just say that Egon Barth said they would decide on peace and war at these conferences. And you've never heard about Bilderberg before. And now I ask you, are you serious? Who is paying you for your research work, which, as you don't even know that Bilderberg exists and where peace and war is done? And I was screaming, and in the middle of the sentence, my voice broke off, and he recognized this moment, and now he screamed at me and said, you blue-eyed asshole, do you really believe, you naive asshole, do you really believe the American president, he is voted? Are you serious? Where do you live? Where do you live? I said, that's where we are? Oh, yes, that's where we are. I was totally shocked of this situation. That was one of the most significant moments in my research on Bilderberg.
Yeah, I think you did. You must have touched a nerve, I think. It sounds like you touched a very important nerve. But anyhow, I know you also made an attempt to track down one of the original German Bilderberg participants, and that's not easy because, you know, they've all died. But you managed to find his secretary. Who was that guy?
Well, it was Rudolf Müller, and for really a long time I bumped into this name. Pretty soon, he and Max Brauer, the mayor of Hamburg, Max Brauer and Rudolf Müller, that these two guys represented Germany at the first meeting in 1954. So Max Brauer was easy, as being from Hamburg, but Rudolf Müller always just read that he would be a lawyer from Frankfurt, but I had no clue whom Rudolf Müller would be. So after I've been to several archives, I finally found out that Rudolf Müller was the president of the Wirtschaftspolitische Gesellschaft in Frankfurt, that he was co-founder of the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, which is one of the major newspapers in Germany, and that he was in the board of several big companies in Germany, and that before that he was finance minister after the Second World War in 1947 in the so-called B zone. So it was those two zones occupied by the Americans and the British. After I found out that whom Rudolf Müller actually was, I asked at the WePub if there does exist an archive about Rudolf Müller, which didn't exist. And I asked, does there still live someone who personally knew Rudolf Müller? And it's mentioned, yeah, there is this woman, Miss Käthe Koch, living in Frankfurt still. That was back in 2004, I think. And so they gave me her phone number and called her. And she was really shocked when I asked her on Bilderberg, because Mr. Rudolf Müller denied her to work on Bilderberg in any way. But she was his personal secretary for years. And all these papers for the different boards he worked for. But she was never allowed to work on Bilderberg. So she remembered well Bilderberg, the expression, the name. But she also mentioned, I'm very sorry, but I cannot help you at all. So I asked her, I would be in Frankfurt anyways in 2 weeks if I could give you a visit, and she agreed. And 2 weeks later, I came to Frankfurt. She invited me for a cup of tea and had some cookies, and then she said, listen, for 2 weeks, I made up my mind on Bilderberg, and yes, it was something that I can actually give you. because that time I was, it must have been back in late May 1954, she said, which was funny, when you know that the first Bilderberg meeting is took place in late May 54 in Oosterbeek in Netherlands. So she remembered also in May 54, two men came to her office, or to the office of Rudolf Müller, in the case of Bilderberg. So I asked her, whom were those two persons? And she said, well, the one was the Archbishop of Cologne, Mr. Frings, and the second one was Otto John, whom was the Verfassungsschutzpräsident, so it was kind of the head of the intelligence service in Germany. Yeah, well, that was quite shocking to have the Vatican involved directly before the first meeting even happened. Yeah.
This particular Bilderberg meeting is happening at a very important time for the European Union.
I was also quite curious about the Brexit, but now, 3 days ago, I heard that a member of the British Parliament said whatever the result of the Brexit, of the voting will be, they will stay in the EU. So the Brexit is not really the point to me at the moment. But as several finance ministers from Europe meet up at this gathering here in Dresden, and being aware of the world debt, I think that's the core problem they're facing at the moment, how to cope with not letting the stock exchanges worldwide break down. I think that's more of a problem they're facing at the moment.
Would you like to just tell us about some of the German participants in here?
Oh, well, there is Wolfgang Schäuble, for sure. He is the finance minister of Germany and probably one of the more important persons, most important persons at this gathering. But, you know, listen, the frame of Bilderberg is not the EU. The frame of Bilderberg is that the participants are from the NATO states. Mm. So, in the core, and then Egon Bahr was right, it is about war and peace. So I think that is the point we are talking about. It's about military action somehow. Don't ask me what kind of action they plan, or they always say that they do not have, that they do not make any decisions, which I doubt. There was Prodi who once made a statement that yes, they do make decisions, and I would agree. Prodi was also part of Bilderberg, so yes, they make decisions. Don't ask me what kind. I don't even know what they are talking about. Now they talk about the poor's first time in the history of Bilderberg. They talk about precariat. I don't know the English expression of precariat.
The precariat. Yeah, this is a new term for many people.
Okay, well, it's about the studies on the poor's. And yes, as we can see that the earnings worldwide are tumbling of the average people. If all the people in the world would consume as much energy as the United States, you would need four worlds. So this makes the problem quite obvious, right? And we have this debt problem. I think the debt problem, that is one of the core problems they're also discussing here.
Yeah, because Herrhausen, he actually suggested, didn't he, German guy, that they really must give up this debt because it's destroying whole continents.
Yes, Alfred Herrhausen in 1988, he mentioned that in a gathering with the German bankers in Düsseldorf. And yes, also in 89 at the Bilderberg Conference, well, he was not able to proceed his engagement in leaving the debt for the third world countries, as he died a few months later. And as he said, he was assassinated by the Red Army faction in Germany. Well, one can doubt that, really. Bilderberg is a meeting where 80 to 140 people, I think there was a maximum amount of people ever attended, from the NATO states, do meet up for 3 days to discuss topics which are found by the steering committee. The steering committee is represented by two people of each country, and they make up their minds throughout the year what topics should be discussed. It obviously does not fit in with democracy. People can talk behind closed doors, okay, that there is no problem about that. But if they do decide, and as Prodi stated, they do decide, and he was an insider, I just can quote him to say, well, that's not democratic at all. So, no, that makes the whole thing for now decades impossible to accept.
That's Klaus Kopf there, political scientist in Germany, who notably hasn't actually written much about Bilderberg, but he is a successful political scientist. Maybe that's why he got warned off. Martin, also the precariat they're talking about there, how people are going to survive when they're very poor. But also the question he raised there, do you really believe the American president is voted in? This is a question from the, you know, some of the, one of his senior kind of professors.
It's fairly clear that the system is rigged. There is a semi-democracy, there are votes cast, but it's a bit like the Roman Republic. Who do you want, Pompey or Caesar? The ordinary folk don't really get a look in, do they?
And by this time next week, we'll know the result of Brexit, because it should be announced. There's not going to be great long delays like there were in the local elections here in Bristol. It's going to be pretty much counted and announced straight away, so we'll know that by this time next week. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Up next, Makawi and Kamal's Arabian Nights. We're online at thisweek.org.uk, where I'll put links to the various things we've been talking about this evening. I'm on Twitter, at Tony Gosling. Wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the Politics Show at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
An award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.